Well, hello and welcome again to Denton's Perspective, a daily briefing from the Republican and Democratic conventions offered to our friends around the globe. Each morning this week, many of you have joined us and we appreciate you joining us. Each morning this week, we've gathered to discuss the stories behind the headlines and with those who shape and understand them best. I'm Kathleen O'Connor, a member of the Denton's Public Policy and Regulation Practice, and I'll be the moderator for this morning's program. As with yesterday, we're joined again today by former Bush White House political director Ron Kaufman and former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, both of whom are members of our Denton's public policy team. This program series, from the moderated discussion we're about to undertake to the policy open mic with Jeremy Cape from our London practice, may be considered as on the record. A recording of this will be available midday on our website, www.dentons.com. Everyone listening can find out more about the topics we discussed today by following us on Twitter at Dentons. So good morning. It's my understanding, Ron Kaufman, you were out very late into the evening last night with all your friends out there in Cleveland. The first question, you're going to pay a price for that because the first question is coming to you. And we all watched Mike Pence deliver last night, which might be something that might be considered the most important speech of his political career. Ron, you watched your former boss, George H.W. Bush, accept the vice presidential nomination in 1980. What do you make of last night's address, and what do you think it means for the general election for the Trump-Pence ticket?
Oh, thanks, Kathleen. And a couple things. First of all, it does send me down memory lane. I was thinking about that last night. The big difference was the setting, in some respect. If you remember back in 80, Governor Reagan selected George Herbert Walker Bush on Tuesday night at 6 p.m. So he didn't have much time to get ready for it. But he was a seasoned campaigner by that time. For Governor Pence to walk on the stage with less than a week to put his mind together, it's an enormous thing. When you walk to that podium, as Governor Dean knows well, you hit with a wall of sound. And it is a huge stage. But I think the two things that we hope that we'd accomplish last night, one was to introduce Governor Pence and his family, and two, make people realize what a good governing pick he would be for Donald Trump. And you know, it's very important for both sides. There's three things that matter in the close of these campaigns. One is who they pick for VP, two is how the convention goes, and three, the debates. And clearly, for Donald Trump, on one, he got a check mark of doing a good job. The overall convention is doing a good job, and his speech helps set that up, I think.
And Governor Dean, last night we watched as three former Donald Trump rivals delivered speeches at his nomination convention. You've had to make that transition yourself, Governor Dean, from a bitter primary rival to a general election cheerleader. And you understand that emotional gauntlet better than perhaps anyone. So I'd like you to speak to your experience in transitioning between a tough primary and a general election.
Well, first, I do have to say that I think this is the worst managed convention I've ever seen. And the Republicans do a good job. The first night, the story ends up being all about Melania Trump's plagiarism. The second night, Chris Christie makes it sound like a lynch mob, which has now become the slogan of the Republican Party. Lock her up! Lock her up! Not going to play to anybody outside the base. The third night, Ted Cruz gets up and stabs the nominee of the Republican Party in the back in front of thousands and thousands of people in the hall and millions of people watching. This is a disaster. And the reason I know that is because I watch the evening news to see how this plays. The lead story is a side-by-side with Melania Trump and Michelle Obama. The next night, more of the same. After that, the Trump campaign comes out and says, oh, we finally found the person that did that, and she's going to resign. They think they're quelling the story. They would have been better off to say nothing because now it's a three-night story. I just can't conceive of this happening in any convention I've ever seen. And the Republicans usually do a better job than we do of managing the convention. So I just am shocked. in terms of the question you asked, in terms of managing, you know, you do that before the convention. You really, this is, I just, you know, I am shocked by what Cruz did. I thought it was awful. I obviously don't support Cruz or Trump, but I think just in terms of decency, I was just, you know, I was just horrified. I couldn't believe he did that to his own nominee. You make your peace with your loss a long time before. And when I lost to John Kerry, we were the front runner for a while, and then John Kerry took us down, and it's a tough business, and that's the way it is. And you get used to it. And if you're not tough enough to be in the business, then you're not tough enough to be president of the United States. That's my view of it. So you just have to make your peace. It's much harder to get your followers to go along with you than it is to convince yourself that it's over. But I was just absolutely, and all the headlines today are not about Mike Pence's speech at all. It's all about Ted Cruz. I just cannot believe that Donald Trump let him get on the stage without promising him he was going to endorse him. I just can't believe it.
Well, and I think that's an interesting point. And Ron, I'll let you react. I think, you know, it goes back to some of the conversation we've been having this week about the unconventional convention. I mean, we haven't, not since Ted Kennedy snubbed Jimmy Carter, have we seen something
right
like that. And that was terrible too. But I would say you saw Donald Trump. He did a wonderful, masterful job of trying to distract from Ted Cruz. He marched right down, joined the family to great applause, to booing of Ted Cruz. So I'd be interested, Ron, you were there. I wasn't. I'd be very interested, Ron, to kind of get your perspective on whether or not the anti-Cruz booing and hissing, really hurt Ted Cruz for a potential 2020 angle. And just further united the base, particularly that in the convention hall, around Donald Trump.
Listen, I love and respect Governor Dean more than any other Democrat I know. And that's a high praise from the Republicans. this party of mine, God bless us, 3 months ago, Kathleen, we talked about this convention would be deadlocked. We have a broken convention. It'd be chaos in the streets. We had, with all due respect to the governor, a spectacular convention, and the polls will show that. And at the end of this week, Donald Trump is going to end up being ahead in the polls by a significant margin, in my opinion. As far as Ted Cruz, I wish he was half as gracious as Governor Dean is. It's hard. I've won some, lost some. I remember having to be the person who told President 41 Bush that he lost the White House. Not a good memory. But in the end, I think last night, Donald Trump knew in advance he wasn't going to endorse. We did see the speech. The campaign did see the speech beforehand, as did Donald Trump. And he said, listen, I don't care. He ran in hard. He should have his moment of sun. And I think that graciousness, as for your point, Kathleen, united the floor in a way it wasn't quite as good on the first two nights. So we had the best night possible last night, I believe, and I think that the Cruz thing, not a negative, is going to turn out to be a positive. Because the one thing we want out of this convention is Americans and hopefully the world to see a different side of Donald Trump. And I think the graciousness in allowing someone who wouldn't endorse him on that stage for a basic prime time speech, I think, for the volume of who he is, and help unite the party and Cruz people to Trump organization. And remember, again, once the chaos that Governor Dean mentioned earlier, 4 years ago, 200 delegates walked out on Mitt Romney, a lot of Paul folks, because they weren't happy. So this is a pleasure for us. It's been a great convention, and tonight will be the most watched political speech in the history of the country.
Let me just make one point. As you well know, I don't doubt for a moment that this is fine inside the hall. The problem is the vast majority of the people, 23 million people the first night, are seeing this from outside the hall. And all that's being talked about is bad stuff. And I know we all blame the media when this happens to our respective parties, but that is what 20-some-odd million people are saying. That's the damage of Cruz. It's not that I mean, I could argue with Pence's speech, but what's the point? Nobody's talking about Pence's speech today. All they're talking about is Donald Trump getting stabbed in the back. And that is the public perception of what's going on in there, whether it's accurate or not.
Well, that's the press perception. But interestingly enough, there were three different focus groups done last night. And in those three focus groups of undecided voters, all but two loved Pence's speech and made them do two things. Either come toward Trump or go away from Hillary to undecided. So his speech was received by undecided voters, which is kind of important in this whole process, as well. And, so, and like Mrs. Trump's speech really hit a bell with a whole bunch of people, particularly women. When you see this gracious, elegant woman on stage. And I think I can humbly disagree with the governor on how this was playing with real people, not in the CNN broadcast box.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I think, you know, I'm intrigued by your comments, Ron, that the campaign actually saw Cruz's speech. I know that there's been other speeches throughout the week, including that from former Attorney General Michael Mukasey that never even mentioned Trump, that the Trump organization did approve, to your point of them wanting to have an unconventional convention, if you will. With all the processes and distractions in this convention, whether it's Melania's cribbing or Cruz's snubbing, how high are the expectations for Trump's speech, do you think, Governor Dean? I mean, what does Trump need to do tonight to come out of this convention with a bump in the polls?
He needs to stick to the teleprompter version.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to have a good speech written for him by people who know what they're doing. He just needs to stay on that teleprompter message, and if he does, it'll be good for him.
Right. Ron, your thoughts on what we're going to hear tonight from Donald Trump?
To the size of no one, this has been talked about a lot, outside and inside. I think there's going to be two parts to the speech in general. There's going to be the Donald Trump, the magic he brought to the campaign trail. As Governor Dean knows well, because he had that magic, unfortunately, not long enough, but he had that magic. And when you're on the trail and it works and you have these 20, 30, 40, 50,000 people, events, that magic is special. So he has to maintain that magic in the speech while at the same time show this other side of Donald Trump. Take all of what his family said and other speakers have said and weave that in. And then lastly, look American straight in the eye and say, this is what my presidency is going to be about. If he can achieve that, and as I said yesterday, this election is about two things, risk and change. Americans definitely want change in huge numbers. And if he finishes the speech, the most important thing he can do is, in the minds of American people, lower that risk factor. It's going to be a great night for him.
Well, you know, Trump's primary brand was really fed by his willingness, as our colleague Newt Gingrich has said and been quoted, as, you know, Trump's willingness to kick over tables. You know, the question is, does he risk turning off voters by adopting a more conciliatory tone during the general election campaign? And how does he do that when he has been assailed by many groups as kind of heightening the divisions? Do you think he's capable of adopting a more conciliatory general election tone, either Governor Dean or Ron?
I think
that's a $4,000 question. I actually have never believed that, quote-unquote, moving towards the middle is bad for your base. Your base, once the nomination is there, the base, even more so on the Republican side than the Democratic side, tends to be loyal. So my advice is always – now, in Trump's case, it's not his political positions that are the only poison. It's his personal style. I mean, Ronald Reagan had some political positions at the time that were considered very – conservative out of the mainstream, but his personal style was extraordinary, and he won big in that 1980 election. So, you know, that's the big question. Trump has never shown that he can be disciplined for more than about 20 hours in this entire campaign. If he really does keep it together, stay on message, calm himself down, not make the offhand remarks and all that stuff, then he can turn the corner. But I don't think he's going to alienate his base by being by appearing more professional. I think they're in for the long haul, and pretty much no matter what he does.
Yeah, I agree with the governor on most of that. I do believe, obviously, that he's a very smart man, clearly. Very few people can walk into this business of politics at the presidential level, having never run for city council, and do as well as he's done. It's extraordinary. And it is, on both sides of the aisle, quite frankly, the most extraordinary, different kind of election than we know, and none of us really know which is all going to end, I think. But the good thing for Donald Trump, I think the government's 100% right. He's a centrist in the political scale. So his problem isn't going left or right. It's just staying where he is, which is good. I think looking forward to next week, where Mrs. Clinton has been pulled to the almost the social side of the scale by Senator Sanders. She's got a much harder time. She's going to scamper away from the most liberal platform in the history of the country and to get back to that center. And her job, I think, is going to be a lot harder because her problem is ideological, where his is not.
I would disagree with that. When you're talking about building walls and keeping Muslims out of the country based on a religious test that doesn't exist in the Constitution, that's reasonably extreme by most Americans, including Republican standards. And the other problem that I think you've got with that argument, Ron, is that, in fact, the polls actually show that, people don't give a damn about the label of being socialist anymore or liberal or any of that kind of stuff, and especially the voters we need, which is the young people, and, B, what used to be considered liberal or whatever progressive positions are now mainstream. We can argue about whether the minimum wage at $15 makes any economic sense, but about 80% of Americans support that. We can argue about whether we have to fix Social Security or not. I think we do. About 75% of Americans think we should expand the benefits and raise taxes, raise the tax limit on Social Security in order to pay for it. So I think this business about, oh, she's so left and she had to accommodate Bernie Sanders, that's the old style of campaigning. And if I think the Republican Party is going to have to figure out something different, because if they don't, that they're going to soon find out that the rug has been pulled out from under them by the economic privations of the middle class in the last 25 years.
Yeah, I think that the magic in both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump in many ways is this populist movement that's not just here. It's led to the vote in the UK and across the world. There's a populist movement, and I think that kind of change is in the air here. And I think clearly, if the mood of the country is what voters vote on, Donald Trump will be the next president, I think. If he doesn't get to the point where his risk factor goes down, then she will be.
It's interesting you say that. Sorry, Ron, I was having a hard time hearing you. It's interesting you say that. I mean, Trump cruised to this nomination. I mean, it was a bruising primary. We all talked about that. But he cruised to this nomination on a wave of really acute nationalism and populism. But that spirit isn't really unique to just the United States. I mean, we watch a similar sentiment drive Britain to leave the EU. Why do you think, I'm addressed to Governor Dean, because you touched on this a bit on Monday during our call with Speaker Gingrich. Why do you think this populist nationalism has become so infectious in the last few years? And do you think it's kind of the new permanent fixture of global politics?
I think it's a warning to both the leadership in the business community and the leadership in the political community, regardless of what party you're in. And that is, globalization has been enormously successful. It's lifted the economy. It's created a huge increase in GNP all over the world, and even in places like Africa, which had previously been struggling, even in places like Brazil, which is struggling now, but it had an extraordinary renaissance economically. We're now running into the problem that about half the people in the world have been left out of the benefits of globalization. And mostly has to do with the fact that the changes have happened so fast because these are not driven by trade agreements. Trade agreements are a byproduct. This is driven by the extraordinary capacity of the Internet to change the rules of commerce, to change who gets to do business with who. I mean, the changes are just shocking. In 20 years, we changed the world in the way that it took 1,000 years between 0 and 1,000 A.D., or even 500 years between 1,000 A.D. and the Renaissance. I mean, the time compression is extraordinary, and there are a hell of a lot of people who feel tremendously dislocated that. Part of it's about race and different people living near you and being present and all that stuff. And you saw that in the British vote and in our politics here. But a lot of it is simply economic. These folks can't compete anymore. The school systems are not turning out people that have the skills to do this, or they are now, but not as much as they need to be. The retraining programs are miserable. 55-year-olds are having a really hard time adapting to this incredibly new, very quick, very flexible economy. That's what's going on, and it's going on all over the world. I used to think it was a product of Western democratic states, but I now believe that it's happening everywhere. It's just that you saw it first in Western democracies because they're freer and people can more publicly express themselves. I think this is going on in China. I think it's going on in India. I think it's going on in Russia to a certain extent.
I second everything Governor Dean just said. I think it's extraordinary, and it's really impacted in a huge way politics, and I believe in a negative way. In some respects, that people get polarized so easily now when all they do is watch CNN versus MSNBC here in this country, or on their iPad or on their iPhone. They get so much information, and it's almost frightening to them. And quite frankly, if you're a little bit older, like Governor Dean and I, our generation is even more frightened by it. And it adds to that desire for change, I think, and fear, honest fear of what this means for our kids or our grandkids. At least the populism, I think, is out there now.
Right. It's a definitely interesting. Overnight, Donald Trump spent some time with the New York Times talking about his foreign policy and how he was going to, before he agreed to be helpful to a country, to check a ledger to see whether or not they paid their bills. You're kind of seeing, Ron, maybe perhaps, and I'd let you react to this, a bit of an ad hoc foreign policy mantra coming out of the Trump campaign. But it's also, I think, perhaps driven a bit by this nationalist populist tone. Do you have any thoughts on any of his comments? I don't know if you saw them overnight or any of his kind of foreign policy thoughts.
Yeah, I think his remarks last night, we were working until way too late. But I think in general, Catherine said is right. I think that he is responding to the fact that most Americans, by large numbers, are afraid about what's going on in this world. They're afraid of terrorism. They're afraid they don't understand what's happening in the Middle East and Nice or in Paris or in this country, and it scares them to death. They grew up in a country when you went overseas, you wore an American flag, and you rappel because it was a safe thing to do. You're proud of that. They honestly believe, fair or unfair, that our country is in decline, particularly economically and internationally. I think most Republicans in particular think that a strong, powerful America is the greatest chance for world peace. And they see the decline of that being bad, not just for this country, for every country. They do see this immigration problem, which is a worldwide problem. You can't solve it here. You have to solve it worldwide. But it's disrupting the economy here, and it minds many people. As the governor said, I think they believe it. Right along, they believe it's making their paycheck smaller every single year. So all that disquietness reflects, I think, a lot in the things that Donald Trump says and believes.
Interesting. Governor Dean, do you have any comments on that?
No, I do. I mean, I have to say that and I'd be interested to hear what Jeremy says about this. I have to say that the remarks of Donald Trump in the New York Times is exactly why I think he should never be president of the United States. The problem is you can make up a lot ad hoc, and obviously Trump has done very well doing that. You can't make up foreign policy ad hoc. What he essentially said is that he might not come to the defense of a NATO NATO nation that has been invaded by Russia. You can't say those kinds of things. Even if you think them, you can't say them, because that emboldens Putin to do something he might not otherwise do. And that is what Trump has no understanding of whatsoever. Words matter. You can get away with a lot of populism and a lot of crazy stuff at the convention. You cannot do that in the front page of the New York Times, which I can assure you the KGB or whatever its follow-up equivalent and Vladimir Putin are paying attention to. That is so foreign policy, which is constructed by very smart people who are very far behind the times and have lots of problems. I think that's true in everybody's foreign policy establishment, not just ours. It's going to lag these lightning-fast developments. In many ways, kids are conducting their own foreign policy. It's why Brexit was so incredibly unpopular in the under 35 set. They see themselves as citizens of Europe, not citizens of Britain, and the Brits have just taken the government, just took something away from them, which is their ability to travel and work and go to school in other places, just like we do. The equivalent is essentially Brexit means somebody from Vermont can't go to school in Texas now. It's ridiculous. But that view, the foreign policy establishment is all Ron's in my age. They don't get it at all. Trump doesn't get it at all. When we change, economic policy changes because we're still a fairly free market world, more so than most people might believe. But foreign policy has never been a free market, and there have been lots of mistakes, and most of the mistakes are made by people who don't know what they're talking about, or even if they do know what they're talking about, they say things they shouldn't say, and all of a sudden there are armed invasions and things going on that you now have a major problem with. I don't think Donald Trump has any notion of what he's talking about, and I can't even figure out who his foreign policy advisors are, so I could at least have some idea of what he was hearing.
Interesting. Ron, do you want to react at all to that?
Yeah, this will shock you. I have to agree with the governor and disagree with him. I do agree with that, and I do agree that foreign policy in particular, it matters. I hope that this election, in my opinion, is decided on foreign policy, because by a vast majority, Americans believe that the President, Mrs. Clinton's foreign policy has been a disaster, and particularly because of things the governor just said, that this president doesn't understand foreign policy, and he says one thing and does another. You can't draw a red line in the sand and say, if you cross that line, there will be consequences, and then Putin crosses that line, and there are no consequences. It leads to a weakening of Americans' position in the world, our strength in the world, and that hurts everyone across the world. So if this election is decided on foreign policy, get ready for President Trump, I think.
Well, thank you for your thoughts, Ron. And that just allows me to segue Governor Dean to some of the banter this morning and overnight in the media has been about Secretary Clinton's remarks at some point saying she wanted somebody on her ticket with significant foreign policy experience. Do you have any thoughts on, with the Democratic Convention beginning next week, on Hillary Clinton's potential pick of whether it's Tim Kaine or whomever else you might want to help us speculate on?
Well,
how long do you think she'll wait until she announces her vice president pick? Do you think she's going to try and step on Trump?
I don't know. Oh, no, I don't think she's going to try to do that. I'd be surprised. What would be the purpose? You'd step on your own vice presidential nominee. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not involved in the vetting process, and I'm not involved in the selection process. I think this former general, who is the head of the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts, which is one of the four or five most respected foreign policy think tanks in the country, universities, is real. I think his name is Sturtevius or something. I don't have it right in front of me. I've never heard of him before. I don't know where that came from, and I was fascinated, and I have to say, all I know is that I've seen his name and he's being vetted, and he's a serious candidate. So that would be extraordinary. I think the others are the more conventional ones that everybody's been gossiping about for the last couple of weeks. And I would repeat something I said yesterday, when you hear speculation about vice presidents, those who say don't know and those who know don't say. So it's hard to get real information about this.
No, well said. Well said, and we appreciate your candor. We appreciate everyone for listening, and thank you, Governor Dean and Ron, for your thoughts all this week, for participating in our panel conversation. They've been lively and thoughtful, and we really do appreciate everyone's time. And we will now turn our microphone over to Jeremy Cape, who joins us today from London to discuss Brexit and similarities in the popular sentiment across the pond, something that we touched on here as it relates to foreign policy and the campaigns. But, Jeremy, we'd love to hear your thoughts about what's going on over there. So thank you, everyone. And, Jeremy, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Kathleen. Well, it really wasn't meant to happen like this. The referendum on Britain's membership of the EU was expected to be like the 2014 Scottish referendum. There would be the occasional flash of campaigning excitement in a generally dull campaign, a rogue opinion poll or two that would momentarily cause concern among the Remain camp before a late swing back to the status quo, with the UK voting, say, 55-45 to stay in the EU. And we would continue to grumble about the failures of the EU because that's what we Brits do. We grumble, we kvetch, but we don't do anything too radical, too un-British. Exactly 4 weeks after the UK voted to leave the EU, I'm going to delve into some of the politics of how we got here, deal with some of the typical questions that are coming in from the US and others outside the UK, and take a look at how this might all unfurl over the next few months. Let's go back a few years to see the mistakes that were made by politicians who, in acting for short-term political gain, could not possibly have contemplated the wider consequences of their self-centred decision-making. In 2012, in Uno Pizzeria restaurant at Chicago O'Hare Airport, Cameron came to the conclusion that an election victory, or at least a result that kept him as Prime Minister under a coalition government, could only be achieved by promising an EU referendum. Maybe Uno Pizzeria, surely now a tourist destination in its own right, should rename one of its pieces Il Referendum. Whilst the UK's membership of and relationship to the EU may not have been a live political issue for the general public, it rarely featured as a key concern in polls. For several of Cameron's MPs, it was the main reason they went into politics. As someone who was wasting his time in student politics in the 1990s, I can agree. You couldn't get anywhere unless you were sound on Europe. Cameron himself wasn't driven by European concerns, but his early political career was defined by his proximity to European snafus. He had been an advisor to John Major's government during the Maastricht Treaty rebellions. He had been in the Treasury on Black Wednesday, when the UK was forced out of the exchange rate mechanism. The EU's divisive tradition within the Conservative Party had cast it as a mechanism by which Cameron would, on more than one occasion, seek to bring about party cohesion. Cameron's first pledge on the European question was in the autumn of 2005. To gain the support of the right of his party, he promised to secure the Tories' withdrawal from the moderate European People's Party. It worked. The promise helped Mr. Cameron win the leadership against the frontrunner, David Davis, about whom we shall hear more later. Cameron subsequently made a promise of a referendum on the European Constitution, his so-called cast iron promise. Although, thanks to a French vote on the Constitution, Mr. Cameron had no need to implement this particular pledge, he had gone some way indulging the tide of anti-EU feeling within his party. He clearly felt himself to be a very lucky Prime Minister on Europe and constitutional issues. By June 2012, the number of Conservative members of Parliament demanding a referendum on membership of the EU had risen to 100. Within hours of that fresh demand, after an EU summit in Brussels, Cameron gave a rather scrappy answer to a question that would prove pivotal in the political fate. Seemingly pro-European in tone, he claimed that there were lots of reasons to say that the argument is going in our direction, the argument for staying on the so-called European bus. Cameron didn't mean to sound so pro-European, and the reaction in the press and party panicked number 10 Downing Street. Cameron was immediately forced into hinting at, and later offering, an in-out referendum. One view is that Cameron felt that he wouldn't actually have to offer a referendum because he would end up in coalition with the pro-EU Liberal Democrats, who would veto it. But his gamble did not pay off. On 6th of May 2015, much to Cameron's surprise, as well as Labour Party leader Ed Miliband, who had already prepared his own victory speech, the Conservative Party won a small overall majority. We were going to have a European referendum. Still, it was a referendum that was there for the winning. In 2015, polls showed Remain to be well ahead. In the run-up to the referendum, the polls and betting markets still favoured the Remain camp. The odds of remaining in the weeks before the referendum were broadly equivalent to those of Hillary Clinton becoming the next president of the USA. One problem is that Cameron could not have reckoned for the state of the Labour Party. Led since September last year by Jeremy Corbyn, a veteran left-wing backbench agitator who had previously shown no leadership ambition and currently demonstrates no leadership talent, the Labour Party was unable to deliver its supporters to the Remain camp. Suspicions lingered that he remained totally opposed to the EU and may even have voted to leave. Whatever the reason, Corbyn failed to deliver key Labour strongholds. The wider malaise we can see with the benefit of hindsight is that the referendum had become synonymous with a wider set of structural issues, not always apparent to those in the Westminster and London bubbles. The idea of a remote European sovereign power had become a symbol of an abstract remote ruling elite, and the referendum was the chance to give the elite a kicking, particularly for older generations. Who cared if experts said that leaving the EU would be an economic disaster? For too many in the country, the past 20 years has not seen them participate in the benefits of globalisation's economic successes. The geography of the vote supports this. Whilst Remain won a thumping victory in London, 58% of the poorer northeast backed Leave. Immigration was cited as a principal concern of the electorate in 2015. Immigration from Europe and the rest of the world had been at a far higher rate than anticipated. Over a million workers from ex-Soviet bloc countries that joined the EU in 2004 had arrived. Great if you work for a law firm and want to find a cleaner or a plumber or a carpenter. Not necessarily great if you're a British cleaner, plumber or carpenter. So this, in a nutshell, is how we got here today. Where do we go from here? Well, I've been doing a lot of webinars for US audiences on Brexit, probably done about 10 in the last 4 weeks. And one question I've always had is essentially, surely you're not really going to do this, are you? It's an understandable question. As I previously mentioned, the UK doesn't generally do the unpredictable. It is true that the referendum is not legally binding on the government. It is true that the majority of MPs in Parliament is taking back control are against leaving the EU, and it's true that many mistruths were spoken by the Leave campaign, although, to be fair, the Remain campaign also did so. But I think we are going to do it, although it's unclear at the moment what exactly we mean by do and it. That said, there are some legal challenges underway to determine whether the government can serve the so-called Article 50 notification and start the 2-year process for the UK to leave the EU. The question essentially comes down to whether Parliament needs to pass an act for Article 50 notification to be made, or whether the government can do so unilaterally. The hope of those retaining the lawyers is that if Parliament is asked to pass an act, it will not, or at least it will buy enough time that the mood in the country changes and the UK does not eventually leave. On the first day of the directions hearings this week in the Dos Santos case, one of the cases to decide this point, counsel for the government assured the court that his client, the UK government, held no intention of invoking Article 50 until next year. It appears that the Supreme Court is destined to hear the case eventually, and some legal wrangling is likely. My view is that ultimately the government won't be prevented from giving the notification when it decides to, which will likely be at the beginning of 2017, at which time we'll have an idea of what Brexit might actually look like. Parliament will be consulted, but it won't stand in the way of the executive. The new Secretary of State for Brexit, David Davis, had intimated that Article 50 might be triggered in 2016, which won't happen. His is an interesting appointment. Previously chair of the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee, and he was European Minister under John Major, as well as a front-runner for the leadership contest eventually won by David Cameron, Davis may prove a savvy appointment by Theresa May to cement the loyalty of the Tory right and to send out a message that Brexiteers must take ownership of the outcome. Does his appointment give any hint of the sort of Brexit we will see? He wants to take control of trade policy and do more of it with more non-EU countries. Already 60% of the UK's trade is outside the EU. He has identified Australia, India and China as key markets. He wants faster negotiation of trade deals, aiming as a single country, and for the UK to start negotiating those deals now. Whilst negotiating trade deals puts us in breach of EU law, so what, he says. If you file for divorce, why observe your marriage vows? There's a keenness to see elimination or at least significant reduction of tariffs on imported goods, although even economists in favour of doing this accept that it would devastate British manufacturing and farming, which are particularly strong, ironically enough, in the areas voted to leave. Regulation will be applied to companies in relation to their primary export markets. Businesses will not need to comply with EU regulations if they do not export to the EU. Controlling EU immigration will be a sine qua non on any deal with the EU, but an ideal outcome would be continued tariff-free access. The possibility of EU citizens in the EU in the UK on Brexit Day not being able to stay indefinitely afterwards has not yet been ruled out. David Davis is clearly not wanting a Brexit-like model, such as continued membership of the European Economic Area. This is full-on leaving the EU and going out alone, calculating that not only does the EU need us as much as we need it, but that it will be prepared to enter into politically damaging deals. Good luck to him. It won't be easy. Many think it will be impossible. A few words about Scotland and Ireland. Nicola Sturgeon, Scotland's First Minister, would love to rerun the Scottish independence referendum if she thinks she can win it. Right now, she probably can't. However, Scotland voted reasonably resoundingly to stay in the EU, and while Scotland has no legal power to prevent Brexit, it cannot be ignored. Mrs. May, however, has agreed that she would take a United Kingdom approach to the Brexit negotiations. That phrase is deliberately ambiguous. There are a number of complex issues arising in Northern Ireland, and I'm not qualified to give anything more than a passing view on them. Sinn Féin has already called for a referendum to reunite Ireland in the wake of last month's vote. The possibility of physical border checks being introduced on the UK's one land border with the EU is seriously problematic. But the alternative may be internal passport controls between Northern Ireland and the UK mainland, something the Unionist parties in Northern Ireland virulently oppose. And don't forget that the Good Friday peace agreement of 1998 has been supported by EU funds of 1.3 billion euros. Finally, what, if anything, does the referendum say about the possible rise of the far right in Europe? To an extent, the immediate implication of the vote in this aspect is that the once extreme marginal objectives of nationalist groups are now lent credibility. One of their policies, breaking away from the EU, has been vindicated by a majority of sensible, cautious Brits who have never seen an extremist party gain any meaningful foothold in a national parliament. In the Netherlands, the vote prompted the far-right and anti-immigration leader, Geert Wilders, to reiterate calls for a referendum on Dutch membership of the EU. The Danish People's Party jubilantly congratulated the British people on delivering a, quote, stinging slap to the whole system, unquote. And in Athens, the neo-fascist New Dawn Party predicted the outcome would further empower nationalist forces across Europe. Marine Le Pen is the key figure in this discussion. An ex-public defender who first campaigned aged 13 alongside her notorious father, Le Pen has been a vociferous critic of French EU membership, and her party has promised a referendum on the topic. She is currently second favourite to win the French presidency. The tragic events in France this month, and indeed in the last year, have only augmented the French populace's susceptibility to the hard line on immigration touted by Le Pen, as has been evidenced already by an increase in membership applications to Front National following the Nice attack. But Le Pen cannot count her proverbial chickens yet. First, France is a founding member of the EU. It will be more reluctant to sever ties with the bloc it played such a formative role in creating. Indeed, recent polls in France seem to reflect this. Second, Front National may have expelled Le Pen's father after he dismissed the Holocaust as a detail earlier this year. But the party's reputation is too richly imbued with connotations of prejudice, and in particular, anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, to gain real cross-policy credibility in the short term that it needs. Third, and more importantly, even if such credibility were attained, the fate of Marine Le Pen and her Eurosceptic friends will depend on how smoothly Brexit goes for the UK. If things get ugly, and they may well do so, fewer will be seduced by the possibility of Frexit. So even if the vote can be considered an immediate gift to the likes of Le Pen, the longer-term position is less clear. Until about an hour ago, I'd written down a list of 6 predictions as to where the UK would be in 2020. But then I remembered the predictions I made 4 weeks ago and realised they were embarrassingly wrong, so I deleted them. So instead, I'll make some other predictions. I predict that Hillary Clinton will win the US presidential race. I predict that Leicester City will not win the English Premier League next season. And I predict that Taylor Swift will one day write a great breakup album about Tom Hiddleston. Thank you.
Well, Jeremy, we can't thank you enough. We can't thank you enough, Jeremy, for that and for your predictions and thoughtful and very, very good commentary on what is going on across the pond. We thank everybody for listening today, and we look forward to talking to you next week as we unpeel the curtain from the Democratic National Convention. We will be using the same dial-in number, we will have Governor Dean and Speaker Gingrich on Monday joining us for opening day down in Philadelphia. So we look forward to everyone joining us then. And until then, if you want, you can continue to hear a recording of this this afternoon at www.dentons.com, and you can continue to find out more about these topics on Twitter at Dentons. So have a great day, everybody, and thank you for joining.